This week I'm joined by Tim Howes, who is a researcher of modern theology and is ordained in the Church of England. In this episode we discuss Michel Serres' text, The Five Senses, alongside discussions of religion, faith and senses. I wish to thank all my patrons and paid subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you'd like to support Hermetics or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Tim Howes, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you, James. I'm really glad to join you.
So we are going to be discussing Michel Serres' text, The Five Senses, which is a book, as many would guess, on the senses, sensibility, taste, touch, and everything else in between, really, as is always the case with Serres. But before we jump in, Tim, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, and how you first came across Michel Serres.
Well, thanks again, James. I'm an ordained minister in the Church of England, so my day job is to work in a church in Oxford. Various aspects to that, lots of visiting, pastoral work, various services throughout the week. Before that, I did my doctoral work on aspects of political theology, in particular the work of Bruno Latour, to whom we may refer in the interview. I first came into contact with Serres. I think there are various ways in, appropriately, but one that I distinctly recall is a radio broadcast of his on France Inter on the subject of obesity. As you know, Serres lived for many years in California. He frequently comments on the obesity crisis in that country, and you can actually read all of his collected radio broadcasts on that channel, which are a fantastic series of books, currently only in French. But I think what first drew my attention as I heard that broadcast, incidentally, was that rather than mere social commentary on that issue, public health issues, availability of fast whatever, the sort of criteria and diagnostics that we would usually point to, he linked that crisis to a deeper evolutionary route. In fact, I looked this up because I remembered it from back then. He pointed out that all living beings, in fact, even inanimate objects, share an instinct for what he called le stockage énergétique, so a sort of storing or stocking of energy. And as you know, James, the stocking of information is one aspect of life itself, if you like, as Serres defines it. So it was that sort of tangential route in to what was an issue we all understand and comment upon in different ways that first drew my attention to a thinker that was quite original.
Yeah, one question just before I jump in on the Hermetics question, which I haven't noted, so I do apologise, but I think it's sort of key in this situation is as an ordained minister. I mean, I know this is probably a huge question actually, but as an ordained minister of the Church of England, in what ways Serres' work affected and influenced or even sort of helped your relationship with God, shall we say, and faith?
Serres writes a lot about, he refers to religion a lot, as you know. I think he does some interesting things with it. He's always teasing us to understand what perhaps lies behind some of the rites and ceremonies that, for example, the Roman Catholic Church, which he was familiar, signify. I think one of the things he's most prodded me towards is the idea of religion as attention or attentiveness. The idea that one of the things we're called to is to listen to see, to pay attention to the multiplicity of the world, and to be careful how we might impose a premature unification of that multiplicity. One of his great disciples, Bruno Latour, often refers to the idea of le prochain, the nearby, if you like, the Good Samaritan story, the idea of coming near or your neighbor. And I think for all the tangentiality, for all the symbolic use of religion in his work, I think there's a very deep strand of respect for religious attentiveness. And that actually comes out even in this text here.
Perhaps we'll jump back in on that. I'm sure it'll come back up. But I do like to get the Hermetics question out in the start. So you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
It's a great question. I've given this some thought. One of my first loves in continental philosophy was René Girard, anthropologist, philosopher, social, whatever he is, with his great interest in, I think, what differentiates or individuates us as human beings. There's a lot to say there on his account. I worked quite a bit on his thought for a number of years. And as I was delving into some of the documents that found him and the groups that met around him, in particularly in Stanford, I came across one book written by a disciple of his called James Williams, who was an intimate of Girard, and describes going to a dinner party at his house in California one night and being served canapés by a rather dodgy looking but friendly, amiable old gentleman. It was only at the end of the evening he realized that was Michel Serre. So as you know, Girard and Serre were very close friends, and their ideas infuse each other's work in interesting ways. The third member of this triad, I think, would be another person who indeed knows them both. And there may well have even been a dinner party between these three, if you like. And that would be Bruno Latour. Latour was a very early disciple of Serre's thought and wrote an article on him in 1985. And then, as you know, conducted the important interview series with him in 1993, published in English as Conversations. And of course, Latour's debts to Serre are countless. I know him quite well and speak to him quite often, or relatively often. And Latour really is quite disdainful of Serre's influence now, and categorizes him not so much as a philosopher, but, as he said to me, a sage, which was not a term of endearment as he intended it. Lots going on there, but I think it would make for a fascinating dinner party, if you like, one that may well have happened already in some form.
It's certainly interesting. It would be, I think, two really interesting conversations to see would be, obviously, we have the conversations between Latour and Serre in 1993, as you stated, but it would be interesting if, obviously, Serre passed away last year. You know, if those conversations could be repeated now, since Latour has sort of moved away from Serre, and to see what the clear differences would be. I mean, I would always take sage as a compliment, so, you know. I would have certain agreements with Latour that categorizing him in any way is not something I think is ever truly going to stick. Perhaps those thinkers will turn up again, and I think Latour might, with your as you know him personally and know his work probably far better than me. But on to the five senses, and this is one of the questions you added, and I do agree with it. Some of Serre's texts aren't as difficult as others. This is a hard book to read. Do you think Serre provides any tips or guides to working through it? You know, at the start of this conversation, you know, this seems to be an important thing that can seem rare in a Serre book if you don't know his work all that well.
I think there are various tools, even methodological tools or cues, that we could be aware of before diving into the book. I've got a number here, working out, if you like, from the broadest to a more narrow lens. So just stop me when these become boring. The first one, I think, is the biographical explanation. For 30 years, Serre was a smoker, 2 packets of Gitane Brune every day, he tells us. And again, in one of those radio interviews we mentioned earlier, he described the smoke that would emanate from his cigarettes and envelop him as, in French, a cuirass, a sort of metal breastplate, if you like, that would anesthetize his body from contact with the outside world. And he very intentionally tells us that when he gave up that habit in the 1980s, which took him a whole year to kick, that renunciation gave him back a certain sensory experience of the world. He says, actually, I've written it down here, cette délivrance a été pour moi une véritable renaissance. This deliverance was for me a veritable rebirth. That idea of birth into sensory experience is important at the beginning and end of the book. So there's a biographical moment. I think there's an explanation or a tool that can be framed in terms of his writing career. This book does occupy an interesting turning point in his writing style, I think. Again, a quote from the conversations with Bruno Latour. He says, quote, luckily, the more one writes, the younger one becomes. Finally, no more surveillance. Finally, I can play truant. No more school at all. And that quote is with reference to the writing of this book. So there's a certain lightness or deliverance, not only from his habit of smoking, but within his writing career. A third tip, I think, would be an intertextual one. There are other books he has written and published on the body. Variations sur le corps, 1998. That has been translated. And a really lovely short little book simply called Corps, 2011. So quite a late text that is quite a somewhat distillation of the five senses. So if you are a French reader, that would be a good place to start. I think there are other tools as well that are found within the text that could be helpful here. Although it's a complicated progression in the text, there is a certain system to how he writes. Even at the level of paragraphs, we often have A-B-A structure, where a theme is picked up, left behind, or developed in something akin to a sonata form, and then picked up again. And in the following paragraph, you'll find a B-C-B structure, then a C-D-C, and so on. So there's an enfolding and developmental structure within the writing itself that can be of help. There's also things like matched scenes within the text. I'll just give you one example. At the beginning of chapter 3, you have this memorable motif or tableau of Serre sitting down with his bottle of wine with his friend. And he focuses on the silent empathy, as he describes it, between him and his friend as they consume that wine. That little tableau comes out again in chapter 4 in a little parable of the sea, where a captain and a naval inspector sit down over some maps. The captain is able to put aside the pieces of paper that are in front of him, mapping out his navigational routes, and actually describes to this naval inspector the topography of the sea, perhaps even the topology of the sea. And that's described as taking place, just in a parenthetical comment, over a bottle of wine. So there are little moments within the text that match each other and that give a certain internal structure. And if I might just offer one more, I think the opening of each chapter is absolutely crucial for reading the chapter that follows. As you know, there are five chapters. We might assume that they would correspond or correlate to the five senses. As we'll go on to say, they actually don't do that at all. But the beginning of each chapter is crucial. At the beginning of the first chapter, called Veils, we have this extraordinary story of being stuck on a ship in a porthole. And what I'm suggesting is that the incident that occurs at the start of every chapter actually sets the mood for what follows. That's a racy narrative full of pace and danger. And indeed, the rest of that chapter carries on somewhat in that mode. Beginning of the second chapter, we find Serre sitting in a ruined amphitheater in the Peloponnese area of Greece, contemplating silently. And there's a certain silent calmness or serenity about that chapter. The third chapter, which, as we've noted, begins with this bottle of wine, is the chapter in which Serre lunges into his most critical writing. And I think there's some sense in which that chapter as a whole is infused with the haze of alcohol, if you like. The fourth chapter takes a lighter tone because it begins with Serre on a ramble around the countryside. And there's something languid and wandering and patchwork about that chapter. The fifth chapter, which we might need to talk about a little more, is simply called Joy. I think that's a little harder to pin down. But what we have in that chapter are a series of autobiographical anecdotes about Serre's own life and how sensory intuition has become or was known to him as a child or a young man. And indeed, that the opening tableau of that chapter is one that introduces Serre as an individual for the first time into the book. And that chapter actually plays throughout on the pronoun I, so the French word joie with the French word moi, and there's a sort of auditory play on the idea of the self resurfacing. So the beginning of each chapter gives us a little mood motif, if you like, that we can follow as we read. There are others, but I'll leave it there for now as a few tools that might be useful.
And there's a lot there, so it's hard for me to pick or choose what could be really useful. So I think the tools, as you've sort of rightly called them, will come in as we address certain bits from the book. And the one bit, the first sort of section, but recurrent theme that you've addressed is Cognac's famous statue, which is a thought experiment at the beginning of his essay on the faculties, in which there is a statue imagined which is deprived in turn of every sense but one. And the five senses plays with this idea throughout the whole text. So in what ways does it sort of develop this theme?
Condillac was an 18th century French empiricist. He was really the importer of the ideas of John Locke into Parisian society. And you know, if you look on his Wikipedia page, you'll find the story or the anecdote or even parable of the statue. This is a thought experiment, really, that occurs at the beginning of his essay of 1754. The idea here is that there's a statue that's deprived in turn of every sense. That statue is then gradually animated, if you like, as its senses are awakened or opened, and the self becomes itself as the senses are allowed to enter in or to provide the manifold of sensory intuition that constitutes the statue, if you like, as a human being. If you buy the English translation of The Five Senses, you'll have a lovely essay by Stephen Connor at the beginning that makes quite a big deal of the relevance of this thought experiment to Serre's book. Connor points out that this statue is actually he calls it the menace of the text. So in some way, Serre is reacting against this idea of the constitution of the self by senses. And Connor reminds us of medieval sort of iconographic images of the self as a city or a citadel guarded by a wall with five gates, the five senses into which entrance to the city is admitted, or through which entrance is admitted. So the senses are the avenues of approach, if you like, to the human being. I actually think I thought about this a bit earlier. I think what Serre is doing with that image is probably mutating it. If you like, my best effort here would be to say, think instead of the wall around the city, think instead of a moat that encircles and surrounds the city. And if you can think of that moat, as it were, rising up in a swell, the waters of that moat would then wash certainly into the citadel, but out as well into the countryside surrounding it. I think something like that would be closer to Serre's conceptualization of the senses. The senses are things that wash over the world out there. And then there's a sort of backwash to the self. The self isn't therefore constituted by these admissions through the gates, but by this much more complex, percolating, flowing wash back and forth. I just add, though, I don't think Condillac is really the great enemy that Stephen Connor suggests he is. There's a much more subtle animation of the statue going on in the work of Etienne Bonnu de Condillac, one in which the senses actually render us attentive to the world out there. So I think Connor's sort of use of that motif is slightly reductionist. But I do agree that it functions as this philosophical menace in this particular text.
Yeah, I think I'd be in agreement with your reading there, because the idea of a gate generally, it's five gates. In general, one doesn't imagine a gate to be combined with another gate or have an inherent connection with another gate. So to have five secluded gates would be still to privilege the senses in certain ways, if they have a single stream, whereas for Serre, he does make it clear that, for instance, smell and taste work together in certain ways and senses build off of each other. And to have this privileged idea of simply, okay, now I'm touching something or now I'm smelling something, isn't exactly how our senses function, for Serre at least.
He's very keen indeed to stress that. I agree entirely with how you've just described it. At one point, he talks about a bouquet, which works in English because, of course, we have a bouquet is a smell, isn't it? It's an aroma of wine, but it's also a bunch of flowers, and you need to imagine the stalks of those flowers clumped together. He even goes as far as to say, imagine that piece of string that's tying together the bouquet. If you were to sort of squeeze that piece, pull together that string, then you might, as it were, prompt the aroma of those flowers to be emitted. So there's certainly a clumping together, an overwash, a bundling, a mingling, a looping together of the senses. And I agree entirely that the idea of individual gates into a city does not fit that purpose at all.
And I think I'm someone who pushes metaphors to their absolute limit, but the idea of a city actually sort of leads into the next question. If we can think of the idea of a city, I think for Serre in terms of the senses would also be a bit troublesome, because it's sort of completely constructed. You're entering into something which is going to be defining what's heading into it via its own sort of machinations and movements. And this seems to me, this comes up time and time again with Serre, but it seems as a that would be a position of language. You know, the senses, when they enter into language, they enter into the city, they change into something which has been just altered from what they truly were. In that way, I think the five senses then is, do you see it as a book with an undercurrent of an anti-language, with an anti-language position?
Yes, indeed. You're right. Serre is always wary of entering through the narrow gate, if you like to use a biblical metaphor. In fact, I think I can't remember if it's in Rome, or he talks about une petite porte du guichet, which is a little like a ticket office or some narrow way in to a venue through which you're required to pass. And he would identify that narrow gate, that sort of administrative function of the ticket office, with something like Cartesianism that takes one model of the world and makes exaggerated claims for its explanatory function. As you know, the great theme of Serre's work is that models need to be nested within, above, through, and beyond other models, such that there is this generalization of reality. And it's in that larger structure that truth resides expansively. Language, therefore, would be a candidate for that little ticket office, if you like. This manifold of sensory stimulation that is out there in the real is forced through a little ticket gate. I think we have to remember that Serre was writing in the 1980s, in the heyday of French linguistic philosophy, if you like. You don't need to look very far at all in any of his work to see his reaction against that. a quote from his conversations with Bruno Latour. My book, The Five Senses, cries out at the empire of signs. He's reacting against the idea that only that exists which we perceive through language. I would recommend here Chris Watkins' recent book, Figures of Thought. I think you've got Chris coming up on this series somewhere. He has a fantastic chapter on language. Says understanding of language as emanating from and returning to the rhythms of the wider world. And so if we privilege or carve out a distinctive role, what he would call an umbilical function of human language, we're actually impoverishing ourselves because we're losing contact with the other models of language that are out there in the world. And those models, as you know, would range from animal sounds to sort of the sounds generated by our own bodies. He's very interested in those in chapter two, all the way up to, if you like, the cosmic hum, the noise that is all around us in the background. Language is an appropriate distillation out of that background noise, and it makes sense as a model from that. But if we turn it into the only or the privileged understanding of language, we're prematurely unifying that which is multiple and fractal that is out there. So yeah, absolutely. The empire of signs, if you like, the mortal enemy of the five senses. And it's a target of venomous critique, a critique that might surprise readers of other books by Michel Serre, where the tone is expansive, embracing, emollient even. There's a certain rapaciousness and anger evident in this book, perhaps, as I said, fueled by the wine that's consumed in chapter three.
It's the catch 22 that I've run into time and time again with Serre, which is this relationship between signs or language, information, or and not information, sorry, that would be the wrong word, but signs and language and senses, and one never being able to truly be explained in a text. And Serre sort of, I think, covertly emphasizing this point that in the act of writing about these things, something is already being lost because you've already gone beyond the sense by writing about it. So there's always this sort of inherent problem, which is why perhaps he never truly writes the position as clear as one could, because you have to work with them in the ways that you can and find ways and tools to actually get back to the senses in that way.
It's almost an oxymoron, isn't it, at the heart of this book, that Serre is looking to undermine language through language. He's seeking to write about a real world that is generalized above and beyond language, in language. And he refers to this throughout the text. And actually, there's a progression in the text. There's an initial hopelessness or even despair that his own words could ever represent what the senses give us at the beginning of the text. By chapter five, that has evolved into a much more optimistic and hopeful stance. He looks to write, he believes in the end that his book has, as it were, opened the veil to the real world, the same veil that we find in that extraordinary tapestry in chapter one that's itself framed by language, but which seems to close off the real because of language. So I think that's another tool through which we can approach this text. How is a text going to address a real that is somehow above and beyond language itself?
Yeah, moving into chapter one, one would think so far that something has sort of been avoided in our discussion of the senses, which is the peculiar and extremely interesting place for Serre for the skin, and specifically the function of the skin. And this plays a big part in chapter one. So I was just wondering if you could expand on Serre's understanding of the skin and the place it plays within our senses.
I think in chapter one, Serre describes a certain imbalance or asymmetry to our bodies. And it's quite evident to see that, as if you can imagine this hilarious scene, really, of his own body being stuck in a porthole on a ship. At his feet is the threat of heat. There's a fire down below. Somehow he's got himself wedged in a narrow opening. So his torso and head are out there in the freezing cold. And he actually describes his soul. We might have to come back to what he means by the soul, but somehow the essence of himself tips between that fulcrum. So as his toes get singed by the fire, he senses his soul being down there. As the waves batter his frosty forehead, he senses the soul switching and going up out there. There's something about an asymmetry in the body. And of course, this would contest all sorts of philosophies, essentialist philosophies that seek to essentialize the human self. The skin, therefore, is the sort of veil, is the surface through which that asymmetry occurs. The lovely example he gives, if you like, is the driver. I mean, I was driving earlier today and went a couple of miles and suddenly realized that I had driven unconsciously. Myself was somehow extended away from the rational part of my body out into the world. If you like, my soul had tipped over out of my head or my heart into the bumper of the car, and it was, as it were, ahead of me. Or think about the soul of the pilot of a ship, says Sayre, who somehow his being is no longer simply himself as contained within his skin, but the ship itself. He, you know, she is me, he might say. I am the ship. I sense the prow as it pushes through the water ahead of me. So the skin is this extraordinary meta sense, if you like, a point of contact in which the soul is located. And that's why you have this series of images, tattoos, for example, or a sheet with folds and planes in it, if you like, because the skin represents that mingling. It represents the self sort of disorientated from its stable center and going out there into the world. Now, of course, the skin... our skins can harden or blister. We can have a sort of swollen skins. Perhaps that goes back to, you know, I mentioned the idea of the breastplate at the beginning. You know, Sayre's own skin had become hardened through the act of smoking. And I think language would be a sort of hardened skin. But what he's encouraging us to do is develop a soft skin, a skin that is pliable, that can fold over the world. And if you like, that goes back to the idea of the backwash of the moat. Our skins need to be that tactile surface on which bumps and lumps, impacts from the world can dent us and create that asymmetry that through which the self is constituted. And I think that's what's so fascinating about Sayre. There are plenty of French philosophers that have decentered the self, but he is one that re-centers the self through that asymmetry. And that's why I think the first chapter focuses on the skin and on touch as a sort of meta-sense, if you like.
So do you think that underneath this meta-sense, this almost unifying assembly where everything can be sensed and there's a lot of contrasts and reactions and actions happening, do you think this is sort of intended, the self then for Sayre is more a tapestry than a prior idea of what the self is? The self is, in this way, it comes across as quite like a fragile tapestry, which if it hardens itself, it ends up actually damaging itself more. And it's in softness that it can learn from the world and react to things to a greater degree and understand things better because it's, you know, allowing them to adhere to its system. Whereas if something is, you know, hard or, you know, Deleuze might say overcoded, there's this impenetrability that it won't let it in. And Sayre, as you say, comments about the cigarettes, and that is what cigarettes do. They stale out all your senses until, you know, and I've been in the exact same position as Sarah, actually, of sort of a month after quitting cigarettes, and you take, I distinctly remember having a burger with some tomato and it being absolutely astounding, beyond anything I've ever tasted. But yeah, anyway, back to the point, the idea of a hard skin or a hard self, it needs to be more of a tapestry to allow things to enter into it.
Absolutely. And well done, by the way, on your personal journey. I think that's fantastic. I mean, I think we need to be a little bit careful with the metaphor, if you like, because hard and soft are going to be important. Almost are going to be inverted later in the text. Hard for Sarah will indicate the hardness of the world out there. Softness will become this idea of the empire of signs, how that hardness is mollified through language into something that is actually artificial. But I agree entirely, that hardened, blistered skin. I think at one point Sarah likens it to something like the swagger of a drunken lord. So you might think of some 18th century nobleman, you know, brandishing his saber at somebody to whom he has taken offence. It's this sort of substantialized, prideful essence that can be mollified through the soft skin and introduced to the world as it really is. And I think the tapestry is a great image, one that he uses in chapter one, because, of course, though we see on the outside, on the front side of a tapestry, we see order, pattern, substance, if you like. As you turn over the fabric on the underside, you see knots, interweavings and complications, complex ravelings of threads and so on underneath. And I think in a sense, Sarah will never seek to undermine or disregard any reality. What he will always invite us to do is turn over the tapestry and see how that one model, which is real in itself, is nested in a structure that exceeds it. And I think that's the beauty of Sarah's thought for me. He always invites us to ask more, to look deeper. And in some ways, that goes back to your question about my own take on Sarah as a religious believer. I think one of the things I've learned from him is to always find more, go deeper, see where your reality nests into a larger reality. For me, that reality would somehow be given transcendentally. For Sarah, that is problematic, but I don't think incompatible.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to continue the idea of this tapestry with the two sides, where there's the one you can sort of accept and you can be content with it, but there's the understanding that there is this more, and there's a complexity and an overlapping and a crisscrossing and a interweaving of many, many things that one can go into and discover if one finds, and there's beauty in that as well. Do you think that the in-between of these two, and the way that one actually, as you say there, strives for more, is in relation to Sayre's theory of noise, in that one, to be able to attend to this more, one needs to be able to discern noise and differentiate noise and what that is they're going towards. I'm sort of clutching at this metaphor, trying to make it work. But it seems to me that the back of this tapestry almost works as an idea of noise, which comes up in chapter two.
Yes. I think the idea of seeing or grasping or comprehending some deeper truth is likewise going to be problematic for Sarah. He describes the idea, he often runs his fingers over the underside of the tapestry, if you like, on the knots and the weavings, the surface, the topographical surface of that underside of the tapestry. And in some ways, that's the invitation he's making to us, to turn over the tapestry and to run our fingers over the underside. I think, in a sense, that operation would then have to be multiplied exponentially. And as we do that, we begin to enter into the Sayersian reality, if you like. It can be simple, as simple, however, as a single touch. Again, in that chapter, he picks up on the myth, the fairy tale of Cinderella. I've been watching Cinderella with my young daughter recently. And as you know, the sort of she becomes a self, if you like. She becomes who she was destined to be by trying on the slipper. Now, I think in the Disney version, we have a glass slipper, don't we? Vert in French. Esther actually goes beyond that. He looks deeper to the original myth, if you like, and discovers the word vert, V-A-I-R, which is an old French heraldic term for fur, possibly squirrel fur. So the idea is that, as it were, instead of slipping your foot into that glass slipper with its smooth surface, you want to slip your foot into that furry slipper. And as you feel those undulations and roughness, you'll, as it were, be sensing the variation that is the essence of that fairy tale. Because, of course, becoming something new is what happens to Cinderella, notwithstanding the problematic gender connotations of that fairy tale, of course, which are pretty horrific as I watched the Disney version. Her happiness is found in the arms of a prince, and I hope I'm not conveying that to my daughter.
Moving forward to another sense, because I mean, this is such a not, I don't want to say dense, but for, as I stated at the start, and as you made clear in your notes that you sent me, this is a complex book for Sarah and a difficult book. And I think, you know, we should try comment and make it clear how the senses are working. And it seems almost in a certain way that vision needs to take a back seat right now, because that's for Sarah has been done. And it's almost, when he talks about vision, it's done in the sense of understanding it as at the top of the sort of unconscious sense hierarchy. So moving on to a different sense, in chapter two, there is a... Sarah begins to talk about hearing and auditory senses. I was wondering if you could just expand on how Sarah sort of views hearing.
Well, I'd certainly agree that vision, sight, is relegated in this text. As you know, sight comes out somewhat on top of the senses in a physical sense, eyes slightly above the ears on most faces. But it doesn't receive its own chapter, really. The fourth chapter, entitled Visits, mutates the sense of sight in a very interesting way. And actually, I was reading some Wordsworth the other day. He calls sight the most despotic of all the senses. So in some ways, the primacy offered to sight is what is to be deconstructed in this text. Hearing, however, is a sense that Sarah makes much of. Chapter two begins with him in a silent state, this theatre of Epidaurus in Greece. The given approaches me quietly, he says, I listen. So that is the attentiveness to the world that, if we like, we've all described as coming through that veil of skin, is now coming to him through the air, through the silence of the theatre. Remember, Greek theatres were opened out to the world. The whole point of the backdrop of tragic theatre was that you were looking out onto the world itself, the great vista of the horizon. Then enter a group of tourists who are offering what Sarah describes as din, a lovely word. A rabble of presumably British tourists enter the scene, chatting away with their guidebooks open, discussing, analysing the acoustics, even shouting out to have that sense of the acoustic that the theatre offers. And it's that din that Sarah, that din of the tourists that Sarah will identify with the din of language, if we allow language to become that. I think hearing is so special to Sarah because it comes at us in this amorphous way, if you like. It just comes to us, doesn't it, in the air. And in fact, he'll describe the whole body as an ear. We hear through our skin and feet, he says. We hear through our skull, abdomen, and thorax. We hear through our muscles, nerves and tendons. Our body box, strung tight, is covered head to toe with an eardrum. So hearing is, as it were, an antidote to the ruthless din of noise, of language. And he'll identify that din with various characters as the chapter goes on, particularly Socrates. But he'll constantly be inviting us to sort of hear a deeper noise, if you like, the noise of the body, the noise of the world, the noise, all those noises that the noise of the collective drowns out.
As you've commented on it, and it does appear in this text, and I think it's come up twice in two separate interviews, but the sort of now, at least in this series, the infamous passage where Ser makes his sort of fatal comments about Socrates in relation to noise. I was wondering if you could relay this happening.
Well, it's a very dense passage, actually, in chapter two. I think for Ser, Socrates is the instigator of language as law, if you like. His language defines him right up to the very point of death. And of course, as he consumes the hemlock, Ser, I think, describes the power of that drug working from his toes up. So you have to almost imagine him lying on his stone slab. And first of all, his feet become immobile, and then his legs become calcified. His body is dying, if you like, from the feet up. And it's his mouth that is the last thing to be silenced. So if you like, this, the despotic sense of the sight that we referred to earlier is here linked to the mouth. It's that ability, that proclivity of Socratic logic or the logos to analyze, to cut, to dissect, to constantly be categorizing reality. It's the reinstigation of those five gates, if you like, around the citadel. And so in a sense, we have Ser celebrating the death of Socrates as the death of a logos that, as always, is legitimate in its own modelling, but needs to be nested within a more general worldview. And actually, instead of Socrates, Ser turns to these strange seers or haruspexes of Roman times, you know, these soothsayers. And he says, actually, where Socrates is characterised by endless speech, what he's interested in are these soothsayers who look at the flight of birds. You know, and they would advise the emperor on the basis of the movement of crows in the air. And actually, he privileges their knowledge over the knowledge that Socrates offers, because they're observing what's independent of language, the flight of birds, random, aleatory, meaningless, if you like. But in some sense, they are the first accedors to the logos, even ahead of Socrates, because it's the logos of the world that they're observing. It sounds mad, doesn't it? I mean, what logic does that does the flight of birds connote to anybody?
Well, I think that would be the beauty of it, in that the logic that is acquired via sort of the combination of senses and the sort of Socratic method, the sort of oh-so-human logic, is one that is never going to be able to be avoided. And the logic that comes from something elsewhere, such as the flight of birds, or even one could argue the way a grape tastes that's about to go into wine, isn't something that can be logically controlled. So the logic of that is, I guess you could argue sort of a non-logic, because it just cannot be, as soon as it's explained, it's destroyed. And I always love the metaphor which Foster Wallace gives, actually, in one of his books, where he says, what a lot of logic seeks to do is to crush up a rose and push it through a spectrometer to tell you why it smells good. And yeah, it's the, you know, the destruction. Yeah, heading forward into chapter three, this is one that I'm sort of really excited about, because obviously you're ordained, and religion clearly plays a probably almost the biggest part in your life. I mean, I don't know. But this is where religion sort of takes a bigger part in the text as well. And what role does religion begin to play here?
He offers a riff on the Last Supper, of course, in this chapter. So having begun with his bottle of Chateau Yquem, incidentally, I had a little look into that vineyard earlier on, and the success of that wine, he drinks a 47 vintage. The success of that wine actually stems from that site's susceptibility to attack by noble rot. So the beauty, the pungency, the fragrance of those grapes is itself a function of compromise, degradation, entropy, if you like.
The parasite.
The parasite, yes. But of course, his interest in the Last Supper is not theological. It's in the idea of a repeated event that encodes a flow of time and space. So what happens when we celebrate communion or at that Last Supper event in the upper room? Well, there's a chalice. The chalice contains wine, which is a blended liquid, if you like. That chalice is then passed around, or the cup is passed around. And if you like, as the disciples sip from the cup, they become constituted. They become who they are, disciples of Jesus, quasi-subjects, if you like. In John chapter 17, Jesus talks of the unity of his people that's given in the context of this Last Supper. So they become a collective, but it's not the collective of those noisy tourists at the temple who are shouting out the noise of the world and, as it were, abusing sensory intuition. It's a wonderful moment, isn't it? That sip of the cup, as it were, emblematizes or even instantiates disciples of Jesus. It's interesting, in our own church, we've, as everybody has, been struggling with the procedures we must adapt in relation to COVID. One of the things we've done is to deny the cup. We've withdrawn the chalice from the congregation because it's not, from a health and safety perspective, we can't be sipping from the same cup. And I think that's important, isn't it? Because as you sip the wine, and of course, nobody who goes to communion wants to admit this, but there's a backwash into the cup, if you like. We use silver chalices by canon law in the Church of England to offer antiseptic properties to the wine. But there's a backwash into the cup. Ourselves, as it were, become the asymmetry of ourselves, washes back into the cup and then is given to the next person. So we have this wine, which itself embodies mixture and mingling. I mean, just think how the wine is produced. You know, the complexity of procedures that takes place in a vineyard. The encoding of a particular terroir in that bottle of wine. I don't know if you discuss this elsewhere, but Sarah always contrasts a bottle of good wine with a can of Coke, because a can of Coke can be known from its label, if you like. Its ingredients pinpoint its essence. But a bottle of good wine encodes a history, a spatial topography, but it needs to be activated. And I think this is the final point, that the Last Supper or a communion is an event. That wine doesn't become the giver of a self if it's kept in the bottle. It needs to be uncorked. And actually, Sarah likes this to the human testicles. If you like, the testicles hang down in a cool environment away from the body, in the same way as a bottle of wine is kept in a cool cellar. But its life-giving properties, if you like, have to be activated. That wine needs to be brought out of the cellar and enjoyed with friends. And that's why the act of love infuses that third chapter as well. It's a life-giving moment for those who celebrate around the table.
Well, yeah, one thing that came up in the Gustatory Aesthetics episode that we did was that the can of Coke thing came up, and we focused more on the time aspect, that a bottle of wine is an encapsulated time and an event. And then I put forth the idea then that modern food, McDonald's and cans of Coke, are sort of a Kantian standardization of time. They are striving for an objective same every single time, and that's actually its its quality. But one thing I sort of picked up on there, which I had, I just made a connection with the idea that you were talking about the shared cup of wine that one sips in church, and it strangely mirrors in an antagonistic sense something that Sayre writes about in The Natural Contract with the idea of passing a salad bowl around, except in that instance he is talking about pollution in The Natural Contract, but I think it could be extended in the sense that it's the idea that when you pass around a bowl of salad, one can spit on it and it's suddenly theirs, and there's this revulsion to the idea that someone has sort of drawn their line around it and said, this is mine. And so there's sort of two sides to the same idea there, that there's well, quite aptly in terms of religion, there's actually almost a sacrifice of sharing with regards to the sharing of the wine and the understanding that it isn't a property that you're drawing a line around and saying it's mine. It's something that due to this, you're all there and you're all acceptant of this intermingling. And through that, it doesn't become a private property. It becomes a communal act and event. And I think I just noticed there's actually quite a nice almost sort of spectrum of assembly there, so to speak.
And what is it that Christians are doing as they celebrate communion? That we're remembering a gift given to us. And our, if you like, our unworthiness to receive that. We are not worthy, O Lord, to come to this thy table, trusting in our own righteousness, we say. And of course, Sayre constantly refers to the gracedness, the gracefulness, the graciousness, the grace-infusedness of the world as it comes to us. His ethics is this morality of gratuity, I would say, that we receive sense data as a gift. We can't really give anything back to that. It washes over us and instantiates us and creates us who we are. So there are not only sort of metaphorical echoes here, but I think there is theological ballast to some of this. Actually, I've just noted here, if I was to sum up the function of this book in one sentence, I'd go for this quotation here. Sayre says, I've written this book that you might undergo the quiet treatment of the five senses. It is enough to accept what is gratuitously given. A wonderful statement of what Sayre wants to lead us towards in this book.
Do you think that he's trying to lead us towards contentment? To be content with, just as you said, this gratuity with regards to the senses, to just allowing them, not trying to hone them, not trying to stratify them or capture them or move them in certain ways, but allow the senses to be and to be fulfilled and content simply with the grace of the senses.
I think that's a very apt summary and rather beautiful way of putting it. And perhaps that's what I meant when I referred to religion as attentiveness earlier on. We're attentive to a gift that's given to us.
Moving on then to chapter four and the idea of being attentive and being sort of perhaps led in certain ways is and makes me think of the idea of sight and pathways in chapter four for Sayre. And in what way does Sayre link these ideas, the idea of vision and paths?
This chapter that you might say treats the sense of sight is called visit, and visite is the crucial term here. I mean, what do we do when we visit a place? We might sit in a fixed or static position, I guess. And in some ways, he sees philosophers as having done that. They visited the world from a static position, and their sight has been the mobile object in that arrangement. Their eyes have ranged over the world from a seated position. He instead encourages to move, because I guess visiting does imply movement. It implies turning or moving around an object to get a better look and so on. So we have to go visiting. We have to go out into the world. We have to allow that wash to go not only into the citadel, but out of it. And we have to wander. We have to ramble, is the word he uses, randonner, to sort of wander around without a path. It's not the Cartesian straight path through the woods. How could that ever be the case? We would bump into the nearest tree. But it's to ramble. And the rural landscape of his own youth, I think, is the emblem of that ramble, this patchwork of fields, this reminder of multiplicities. I think somewhere he calls it the fractal face of the earth, which is rather like the skin, isn't it, that we described earlier, bumped, hollowed, crevassed by time. This is a theme that comes up strongly in the book that precedes The Five Senses, which is called Détachement. So pathways, yes, we could have a superhighway through the landscape, couldn't we? Here in Oxford, we're about to have, it seems, a superhighway to Cambridge, and that's going to rampage through various patchwork localities of the countryside around Oxford and Cambridge. For Serre, that is the Cartesian highway, you know, and it's marked by violence, by hegemony, by force. And so I think he would contrast that superhighway with the idea of pathways, you know, little local paths, Odyssean wanderings, if you like, zigzags, rambles. Of course, it occurs to me that the French word randonnée has a sense of the English random thrown into it as well, doesn't it? It's that passing around between villages, around hamlets, each of which is a locality and has its own meaning in its own terms. Serre says it might even have its own god, if you like. It has its own identity, its own motifs, its own meaning within its own walls. But that meaning is only truly realized as you wander around between villages, as it were, nodding to the gods of each locality. So with Serre, there's always a sense of the local in the global and the global in the local. And I think that's absolutely crucial, by the way, to the recent thought of Bruno Latour, who's going to say, what are these local points in our lives? How have they become hegemonic? How have they become concretized and calcified? How is it that we are creating a territory that guards against the other? And how can we begin to zigzag through the patchwork countryside and bring those localities together? So this visiting, you know, the site, rather than the philosopher's site ranging from his comfortable chair onto the tree in his garden, Serre is encouraging us to get out there, to begin to make those connections and to curate the local in the global, I would say.
It actually, what you've said there reminds me quite a, well, makes me think of Serre's theories of language once again. There is a name for this form of city planning and planning and architecture, but I can't remember what it is. But it's the idea of placing paths organically where people will truly walk. And one often finds, in small local towns at least, that pathways are formed by people taking routes they wish to take, or they're efficient, or they're the nice routes. And these are slowly worn away. And then councils, or sort of, you can understand, almost understand it as you say, the superhighways come in and striate with language in a way where it is you should be walking. And then you still see the same path cut across. And it's almost as if those organic local routes, you can't, there is no, they're much like the birds flying in the sky. You can't create that with the form of logic which creates those paths is entirely separate from the one which can artificially create sort of a right-angled, horrible tarmacked path. And there seems to be a sort of an incompatibility between the two.
And I think Serre would say, even where those superhighways exist, when you look more closely, you discover that there is variation, mutability. I mean, think of a space rocket, he says, going to the moon. I mean, in some sense, that's the straightest line you can imagine. But it, of course, a rocket does not follow a simple, straight, monotonous Cartesian path to the moon. It inflects, it is recalibrated in sort of infinitesimal ways by Houston down below. Or think of the, I think another example Serre offers is the wanderings of the people of Israel. I mean, what could be more easy than to wander through the desert from Egypt to the promised land? But it took that people 40 years of wandering, didn't it? And through that wandering, there was judgment, but there was also blessing, and they're sort of coming closer to the God who had called them into that desert.
Thus far, I think one could get the impression,
if they hadn't read Sayer's writing, that is, that this would come across as a pessimistic reading of sense experience, in that we've been privileging the vision and we've been ostracizing all our other senses, and we often sort of smother them and don't understand the connections and assemblages that are going on there, and we don't see the nuances. And yet it never in the, when you read it, it never comes across as this. It comes across as a, not to sound too cheap, but a celebration of finding out that one can experience the senses in this way after sort of lifetimes of capture. And do you think Sayer is optimistic both in this text and optimistic about where we might or could head with our sense experiences?
Yes, I would be cautious in the work of Sayer of advocating propitious moments, historical moments in which things are becoming clearer. That really, in some ways, the thought of Brunet Latour, you know, whether it's the fall of the Berlin Wall or the advent of the Anthropocene, he's always on the lookout for moments that will deconstruct the modern constitution, reintroduce us to this swirling plural ontology and hybrid ontology that lies underneath. Sayer is not the thinker of ruptures, because he's always looking to nest individual moments in a larger whole. But having said that, I think there is a sense of optimism in the five senses, that in some way, globalization itself, the phenomenon of globalization, is inciting us to think in these global, in the local, and local in the global ways. So, for example, he talks about, you know, the fact that we can now move around the world in a few hours rather than the, you know, the wanderings of that Jules Verne describes, the fact that we can understand the space between the Earth and the Moon. These modern technologies are giving us an expanded sense of the global. And so where I think Latour is extremely pessimistic about globalization as something that will open up our horizons, Sayer, writing in 1985, we must remember, is more optimistic about that. He says that he is confident that we can reestablish an equilibrium between the empirical and the abstract, between the sensible and the intellectual. So there is a brightness and an optimism in the five senses that I think carries through to his great texts of from 2000 onwards as well. There's a great moment in the middle of this book that I think is really significant, mm-hmm. Where all of a sudden and out of nowhere, Sayer says, and I'll just find the quote here. He says, I've written this book, he says, as a memorial to empiricism, in the same way that Maurice Ravel evoked François Couperin in Le Tombeau de Couperin. And you think, well, what on earth is this? What on earth is going on here? What does that mean? Well, this is a piano suite written by Ravel during the First World War, commemorating friends of his who had perished in the war. But it's fascinating when you listen to that. It's a piano piece that has been orchestrated. It's lighthearted and reflective tone. It's joyful. It's light. It's bouncing almost. And when he was asked about this, Ravel replied, the dead are sad enough in their eternal silence. And I think that's a really crucial key to this text, that Sayer is commemorating, as it were, the death of language with joy. There's a joyful optimism, a lightness to this book. It's as if he's commemorating a friend that served him to some degree, but which he can now lay to rest, and he can move forward into a brave new world. I don't think that tone is evident at all, for example, in the work of Brunet Latour or in the work of René Girard.
They have do you see them as having a reluctancy or a sympathy? Do you see them as having a reluctancy to move away from empiricism or a sympathy that disallows them to actually detach themselves from it?
I think for Girard, for example, a move towards the real is a move towards greater mimetic tension. And whilst he is optimistic that there is a an unveiling of the scapegoat mechanism that has concealed that since before the foundation of the world, he is very pessimistic that it will come up in these great conflagrations of mimetic tension. And so in some ways, I think Girard leaves us with a extremely pessimistic view of the future. The scapegoat is being revealed, but as it's being revealed, greater and greater acts of violence, apocalyptic violence, will ensue. I don't think that tone at all is present in Michel Serre.
So moving into this, the end of the book with this final chapter, chapter 5, and it's quite a short chapter. What do you see this as this chapter as contributing to the whole of the book?
It's a description of Serre himself in these pleasures of exceeding the self, of regaining that asymmetry of the soul that pushes him out again into the world of the waters of that moat washing back and forth into his soul. It's a series of vignettes of Serre as a child and as a young man engaged in agencies, bodily agencies, swimming, jumping. He describes his own adventures with his, I think, older brother, jumping on their beds as children. And he says that his youth had a trampolinian existence. So there was something about that angelic ecstasy of leaping up into the air and actually chatting to his brother whilst his feet were off the ground. There's something significant in that and joyful for Serre. He talks about merry-go-rounds. I mean, I took our children to a playground earlier today and we were spinning around on this awful thing. As soon as I got on it, I thought I was about to be sick because as an adult, you can hardly bear those centrifugal forces, can you? But, you know, think of the liberation that comes for a child as he spins around in that apparent disorder, but is ordered by the center of the merry-go-round. Or just carrying things. You do not know your body, he says, if your pectoral girdle has never been subjected to weight and been under pressure. So he talks about experiences of sort of carrying injured climbers down on from a mountain on a stretcher. You become a subject as you are subjected to these bodily forces, he would say something like that. So actually the book ends with this celebration of labor, if you like, builders, furniture removalists, if you like. These are the people that can be in touch with the senses way beyond a Merleau-Ponty sitting in his study and observing a tree in the garden. And of course the book ends with that very beautiful sentence. I'll just bring it up for you here. The very last line of the book, or lines, the five senses still on the verge of departure towards another adventure. A ghost of the real, timidly described in language. This is my essay. Imagine. I should have liked to call it resurrection or rebirth. So the book ends with a birth, just as it began with a birth. And in many ways, its whole project is that renaissance of the soul through this writing project.
It's a beautiful way to finish a book, but there's one thing that you mentioned that's actually very interesting. It came up in the Gustatory Aesthetics episode with this idea of actually having a matured taste and people being able to understand, especially tasters in food, greater than others. Chefs will understand if it needs X or Y more of an ingredient. But it's interesting you mentioned going to the park with your daughters and not being able to withstand the senses that they could, as if children almost have a chaos of the senses, which they, due to their sort of level of maturation, is something that they can just sort of withstand. It's almost like their Serrean skin is will just allow anything. And I think actually the biology of that is that the adult mind, as you grow, something to do with dizziness becomes more and more repulsive over time as sort of a defense mechanism. Do you think that for Serre there would be an importance with regard to one's maturation and how their senses may mature alongside that?
Yes, I think the adult senses can calcify, can't they, and harden and blister, as we've already described. I think I was just trying to flick through my copy as you were speaking. There's a lovely passage, I think in the fourth chapter, where he celebrates the childhood of Victor Hugo, who had access as a child to a garden of I think a ruined or a disused convent that was next door to his house. And Serre says, you know, what better education could there be than frolicking in this park? You know, Ugo, the great reader of texts, actually the real text he read was this overgrown garden next door. And I think in some ways there's a lot I can learn from my children in their sort of sensory openness to the world and their reception of the given. And it's possibly not a coincidence that Jesus says, you know, look at these little ones. You should become like a little child, he says. You know, receive the gift of grace that I am giving, he would say, like a little child. Don't be hardened. Don't be prideful. Be ready. Understand the gift that I am giving you, that the world is giving you in Serre's terms. So it's no coincidence that the book is topped and tailed by birth, by childhood, and by youth.
Is there anything you would like to add that you think we've that's crucial that you believe we've missed?
There's so much more in this text. And I'm just looking at the clock and seeing how long we've spoken. It's been such a great pleasure. I think just read and reread. This book lends itself to small fragmentary dippings in, and it's a great place to start. It's full of lively vignettes. It's full of autobiography, and its core message is very clear throughout. So I would highly commend The Five Senses to all readers of Serre, and indeed those who have never read any Serre at all.
Tim Howells, thanks very much.
Thank you.